Autonomic pharmacology is such an important part of examinations regarding USMLE in pharmacology that I venture to call all of autonomic pharmacology high yield. It constitutes perhaps 12% of questions that directly relate to autonomic drugs specifically. But you see, it spreads itself into a great deal of other aspects of pharmacology, understanding how drugs that work in terms of cardiovascular function that are not specifically for cardiovascular disorders in terms of autonomic function is an important part of what you learn when you review autonomic pharmacology. Likewise, when we refer to drugs that might be used exclusively for their actions on the central nervous system but cause adverse effects that are, say, atropine-like or like a beta blocker, then you have to understand autonomic pharmacology to know, you know, what these adverse effects are going to be expressed as in terms of their toxicity. So this is a very important area, and we're going to start at first principles by examining first autonomic, if you like, innovation in a very pharmacological way. The autonomic nervous system has several branches. The most traditional are the parasympathetic, PANS, and the sympathetic nervous system. But we also have a sub-branch called the enteric nervous system that we'll mention briefly a little later. The parasympathetic innervation is thought of as being craniosacral. In other words, the outflow from the cord is at opposite ends, as it were, and the outflow from the sympathetic components of the autonomic nervous system would be called thoracolumbar, in other words, from the middle parts of the spinal cord. There is a difference between parasympathetic and sympathetic anatomically, in the sense that most of the ganglia for the sympathetic nervous system are lined up paravertebrally. In other words, they're quite close to the spinal cord, whereas most of the ganglia for the parasympathetic autonomic nervous system are in or on the tissues. This means that you see a difference in anatomy. Preganglionic fibers of the parasympathetic nervous system are long, and that means that postganglionic fibers are short. And the opposite is true for sympathetic innervation. Preganglionic fibers are short, and postganglionic fibers are long. Now, irrespective of which ganglia you're talking about, we can say that all autonomic ganglia have the same type of neurotransmitter and the same type of receptor. Acetylcholine is the transmitter, whether it's a parasympathetic ganglion or whether it's a sympathetic ganglion. And the receptor is a nicotinic type of receptor referred to as an N sub-N receptor. So when we get autonomic outflow, whether it be through a parasympathetic drive, say the vagus, or whether it be sympathetic innervation to the vasculature, we will have in both cases to go through an autonomic ganglia via cholinergic transmission involving acetylcholine released from the preganglionic nerve having an action on a nicotinic receptor on the postganglionic nerve. Now, if we were to stop for a moment just there, we would probably imagine then that nicotine, which should activate all of these receptors, would have rather diverse effects on autonomic function. Wouldn't you expect that? Nicotine activating a parasympathetic ganglion is likely to cause a certain amount of gastrointestinal irritation because that's dominated by the parasympathetic nervous system. And you're quite likely to see evidence of vascular events occurring with nicotine because, you see, sympathetic innervation dominates the vasculature. So nicotine is a rather, you know, dirty drug, if you think of it in that way, by virtue of knowing about where nicotinic receptors exist. Now, we have another type of nicotinic receptor that is on cells that are not postganglionic cells, but they're cells of the adrenal medulla. There is a nicotinic receptor there which is activated by acetylcholine coming from a sympathetic nerve that comes out of the spinal cord, and instead of actually getting a neural event occurring with activation of that receptor, you get a humoral event occurring, and that is the release of catecholamines. the adrenal medulla, under the influence of autonomic stimulation, the sympathetic branch of that, actually releases norepinephrine and epinephrine. And these are released into the blood, and that's a sort of a neurohumoral mechanism, so that they can go off and activate receptors in tissues, many of which are not even innervated by sympathetic nerves. So if we were thinking again about what nicotine can get up to, we would say that probably it releases amines too from the adrenal medulla. There is a rather different type of nicotinic receptor that has nothing to do with autonomic function, but everything to do with control of skeletal muscle function under the influence of a somatic motor neuron. Acetylcholine released from somatic nerves brings about depolarization of skeletal muscle junction end plates. And how does that come about? Through the release of acetylcholine and activation of a type of nicotinic receptor. It's not quite the same as the nicotinic receptor in the ganglia or the nicotinic receptor in the adrenal medulla. Therefore, we call it an N sub M, M for skeletal muscle, really, type of receptor. But it would still be stimulated by acetylcholine. So that is not part of the autonomic nervous system, but generally we talk about drugs that work on skeletal muscle at the same time as we talk about drugs that influence other aspects of cholinergic function. Cholinergic meaning involving acetylcholine. That's the definition of cholinergic. Now, so far, we've restricted ourselves to the ganglia of the autonomic nervous system, the adrenal medulla, and the skeletal myoneural junction. Let us first address ourselves then to what happens after the ganglia in terms of the parasympathetic nervous system. Remember we said, and this is shown at the top of the diagram here, we said that parasympathetic innervation has long preganglionic fibers and short postganglionic fibers, and that's sort of shown representatively here in the diagram. The postganglionic fiber in the parasympathetic nervous system also releases acetylcholine. So acetylcholine caused activation of that fiber, but acetylcholine is released from that fiber. But unlike the ganglion, acetylcholine here activates a different type of receptor. It's called an M receptor, standing for muscarinic receptor. All of the postganglionic parasympathetic neuroaffected junctions are activated by acetylcholine by one or other type of M receptor. And we have several muscarinic receptor subtypes. Probably we should know at least three of these, M1, M2, and M3. And they're present in tissues including the heart, the smooth muscle, and in the glands. Now, that means it's an example of cholinergic transmission. It does involve acetylcholine. Would you expect nicotine to work on that particular receptor? No. Nicotine works on nicotine receptors, all right? Nicotinic receptors, not on muscarinic receptors. However, nicotine can influence parasympathetic function because, you see, it will stimulate parasympathetic ganglia, but not at the muscarinic receptor directly. It would be an indirect action of nicotine there. Now, that's the story then of acetylcholine. We've got that under control. Now what we have to look at is the sympathetic nervous system from the standpoint of their postganglionic innervation. You notice that there are three branches of the sympathetic autonomic nervous system coming out of the spinal cord shown in the diagram. We've already described, for example, the adrenal medulla having a nicotinic N type of receptor to release catecholamines. But there are two others that we have to take a look at, both again involving acetylcholine. The top one of those two, of the bunch of three that you see in the diagram, actually is the dominant type of postganglionic sympathetic neuroaffected system. That utilizes not acetylcholine, but norepinephrine, designated NE here. And this is the dominant neurotransmitter at the postganglionic neuroaffected junction in the sympathetic nervous system, and can activate different types of receptor, all called adrenoreceptors, right? And they can be alpha and beta, and there are several different subtypes of each of the alpha and beta receptor depending on the individual target tissue. It's going to be our job, you see, to be able to know what that innervation is and what receptor subtypes are there, otherwise we're not going to be able to really get a good hold on autonomic pharmacology, and we're going to have to do that. Now you'll notice, however, there is another fiber postganglionic that appears to be releasing acetylcholine. Acetylcholine can also be a postganglionic transmitter in sympathetic nerves. Not many of them. The most important of these for exam purposes is to recognize that the thermoregulatory sweat glands have receptors for acetylcholine that are muscarinic. Now, normally, you see, we've thought about muscarinic receptors as being postganglionic in the parasympathetic nervous system. They're the ones that we generally think about. But this is in the sympathetic nervous system. And in the sympathetic nervous system to the thermoregulatory sweat glands, acetylcholine is activating a muscarinic receptor. Now, how do they challenge you in this way with this little, apparently innocuous piece of information? They might do it in the following fashion. What would you expect if you increased acetylcholine at that junction, at the thermoregulatory sweat glands? You would expect to sweat a lot. And you would, because this is a thermoregulatory sweat gland. And therefore, drugs that work on cholinergic function to increase acetylcholine have the tendency to do that. What would you expect atropine to do? Remember, atropine is a muscarinic blocking agent. Atropine is going to make you very hot, and you're not going to be able to do too much about it. Why? Because you can't sweat. And if you can't sweat, you can't get rid of heat. And if you can't get rid of heat, what are you going to do? You're going to vasodilate, and you're going to get very hot in terms of vasodilation. And if you're of the right skin pigmentation, you're going to become bright red, right? And that is typical of an atropine action. It's called atropine flush. So this is how they ask you about thermoregulatory sweat glands and how they relate to cholinergic function. Even though it's a sympathetic by innervation, it is a cholinergic postganglionic mechanism. So it's important that you recognize that aspect of the system here, particularly I like to think of with respect to the thermoregulatory sweat glands. It's not the only one. Piloerector muscles can also be affected, and there are some muscarinic receptors of the sympathetic nervous system in certain vasculature. But this is by far the most likely thing to be asked about is thermoregulation. So I do emphasize that very, very strongly. Okay, the next aspect of this is to remind you about it in a sort of a, rather than in a figurative way, in a more tabular way. NN stands for nicotinic receptor or ganglia, whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic, and in the adrenal medulla. NM stands for nicotinic at the skeletal muscle junction, and that's at the end plate. That's not autonomic, that's somatic. That's our voluntary nervous system as opposed to involuntary autonomic. And M stands for muscarinic. That's all postganglionic parasympathetic innervation, and a few places in the sympathetic system, most notably the thermoregulatory sweat gland. I think I've repeated that now three times, so you probably got that squared away. Now, what about adrenoreceptors? Well, these are at all postganglionic innervations of the sympathetic nervous system, and they will fit under the various subtypes of alpha and beta adrenoreceptors. Now, the neurotransmitters, acetylcholine, you know, will activate both N and M receptors. Norepinephrine appears to be the major transmitter of the sympathetic postganglionic neuroeffector junctions. And dopamine in the periphery seems to be pretty much localized to the renal vasculature. And activation of dopamine receptors there increases renal blood flow and is protective in cases of patients who are in shock. One of the important clinical uses of dopamine as a drug is the increase in blood flow to the kidney to protect the kidney in a shock-like state. So that's a little bit different. Chemically speaking, dopamine is only small different from norepinephrine, but it is different in terms of its neurotransmitter role. What about epinephrine? Epinephrine would not be thought of in a classic way as the neurotransmitter in the sympathetic nervous system, but you know, epinephrine released presumably from the adrenal medulla will activate nearly all of the adrenoreceptors that we've ever identified. It doesn't even matter whether the systems are or the tissues are innervated. Epinephrine just gets there and activates all of these types of receptors. Now, we have several other potential neurotransmitters generally thought of as being restricted to either the enteric nervous system, which is a nervous system a little bit different from both sympathetic and parasympathetic, but obviously related to the gut, enteric nervous system, and certainly some of the autonomic fibers that cross over between enteric and ordinary autonomic fiber innervation. Among the transmitters that are present there are serotonin, and many drugs that work on serotonin receptors have gastrointestinal effects, as we'll describe later. Purines are among the category of potential transmitters or co-transmitters here, and a number of peptides. Among the peptides that seem to be present in the GI tract as possible neuroregulators are the opioid peptides, and that is of obvious specific interest to us in pharmacology when we recognize that opioid analgesics work through these types of receptors.